I'm so thankful that I was able to follow Rick's presentation because I think these are going to go really well together. It's kind of a Wesleyan response to where we find ourselves today in children's ministry and parenting. I was recently caught in a crossfire between two of my kids in a heated dispute. As one of the parties stormed off, the other expressed to me a tear-stained, hyperbolic exclamation of contempt for the other. When I asked, "Why do you feel this way about her?" the answer was, "I hate her, sniff, sniff, because, sniff, sniff, she's smart." And so, as mother and child, we began to work through why this was not a valid reason to strongly dislike someone, and how this sentiment likely said more about their own insecurity than their sibling's intellectual advantage or what they perceived it to be. And it turned into an opportunity for me as a parent to affirm the offended child's worth and rebuke the voice of the enemy at work in their precious life, inviting me to repeat to them the promises of Psalm 139 that they too are fearfully and wonderfully made. In later reflection, it also presented me as a parent with the opportunity to confront and repent of my own repeated, ludicrously located angst, particularly in a recent season of ministerial rejection. How many times did I judge someone and turned against them out of my own insecurity? How is this holding up my own growth in grace through Christ? If you are a parent or you have worked with kids, you might relate to this experience. Parenting is without question the hardest work I have ever done. And I have three children to Susanna Wesley's 10. She must have been quite the woman. In a meditation recorded in 1711, the future mother of Methodism wrote, "While I teach, I learn," says Seneca, "and while I preach to others, I instruct myself." Little might she have imagined that as she was penning these words, her son John would later expand on this synergistic understanding to consider how the children of God can act upon each other through God's grace to grow in holiness. And one of these relational dynamics highlighted by Wesley was the spiritual implications of the relationship between parent and child. Now, to be clear, Wesley does not explicitly identify parenting as a potential means of grace. However, there are significant points of similarity between the way Wesley speaks of works of mercy in his sermon on visiting the sick, and the language he employs in his sermons on family religion and on the education of children. In fact, if we look at these sermons alongside Charles Wesley's Hymns for Children and early Methodist practice, it becomes clear that parenting meets the criteria for consideration as a prudential means of grace. It contextually confronts a person at their point of spiritual need, spans the activities found in the Institute of Means of Grace, and includes Christian social praxis. To be sure, Wesleyan theology presents a compelling vision for parents and children serving each other in relationship as conduits of God's ever-present, always available grace. And this vision can be used to construct a Wesleyan model for children's faith formation built on communion between parent, child, and God that is not defined by parental onus, tension, and burden, but by God's operative love, leading to trust and blessing for parent and child. And this is a significant distinction. It's crucial in our current cultural context for Christian parents and ministry leaders to begin to understand that they are not solely responsible for their children's faith formation, but response-abled through Christ by the power of the Spirit. In my own anecdotal experience, the prevailing default has been to understand the ministerial and parental role in terms of burdens. And these burdens often lead to unhelpful and unnecessary tensions. For example, I recently had the opportunity to interview a bunch of children's leaders in my own tradition. And it was remarkable to me how many located their biggest concern, not in terms of attendance or resources, volunteers, but in their own insecurity over how effective they were being in communicating the gospel message. I often heard statements like, I hope I'm doing a good job helping the kids get this, but I'm not sure. I have also faced my own battle with fear and inadequacy as a parent. Am I getting it right? When I'm helping my kids navigate a very different world from the one in which I was raised and discipled as a child and a youth. Yet, as I began to interact with John Wesley on this topic, I started to investigate how, as a parent and children's pastor, how could I understand faith transference and the interaction between myself, my God, and my child, and the children I serve? Am I seeking to be spiritually informative or spiritually formative? Do I view children as blank slates who need to download the data set about God in contrast to the data set of the secular culture? Do I need to win my kids for Christ or be a conduit for God to woo them with his love? As I researched this area of Wesleyan thought, I found myself drawn into a joyous conclusion that parents and communities of faith should be responsive, but are not alone in forming the faith of their children. We are all always present to God together. So, to give you a brief delineation of this idea of parenting as a means of grace, an ordinary everyday channel for receiving God's sanctifying grace, I would like to present a Wesleyan model for family faith formation based on three gifts: the gift of grace, the gift of correction, and the gift of instruction. So we'll start with the gift of grace. Here's a sample from an early Methodist hymn for children. In sin we all are born, to every sin inclined. Our will perverse, our carnal mind is enmity to God. Now, I don't imagine any of us will be introducing this with a fun, fresh beat in our Sunday school classes this coming Sunday. In fact, an early confrontation with original sin might seem less than palatable to postmodern sensibilities and today's parents and leaders, but Wesley was adamant that this encounter was essential. And on the education of children, Wesley writes that children should be taught, quote, as soon as you possibly can, teach them that they are fallen spirits, that they are short of the glorious image of God wherein they were first created. While those who spiritually shepherd children might hesitate to point out the foxes too voraciously, it must be asked. Does this early urgency build tension or diffuse it for parents? Could it function as a pathway for the parent to first experience God's grace? Wesley warned parents that they would find such hindrances on the way as only the mighty power of God can enable you to break through. You will have all the powers of darkness against you, and above all, the deceitfulness of your own heart. Ouch. This echoes the language found in Wesley's sermon on the practice of the works of mercy in visiting the sick. And I find his language parallel here striking. Before you enter upon the work, you should be deeply convinced that you are by no means sufficient for it. You have neither sufficient grace nor sufficient understanding to perform it. This will convince you of the necessity of applying to the strong for strength and of flying to the Father of lights. There is no sense of works righteousness in the Wesleyan works of mercy, whether it was in caring for the sick or caring for the young. Yes, parents must train their children and start young. And yes, it's going to be hard work. But God's love is operative, confronting the parent with their need to receive God's grace for themselves in their duty to their children. So the question is, how can a child be blessed by an early confrontation with their sinful nature? The question must be answered with a consideration of the Wesleyan doctrine of prevenient grace. And Catherine Stonehouse puts this very well when she writes, Wesley held together a belief in the mystery of God's grace at work in the child's heart and the reality and power of sin and evil. When Wesley writes that, quote, no man living is entirely destitute of preventing grace, every man living has a greater or lesser measure of this, it's important to consider that this concept is not age bound. Parents can be encouraged that as they teach their children about their broken natures, they may become receptive to God's gift of grace, which is already kinetic and already ready to respond. Prevenient grace releases parents from the burden of activating faith, inviting them into partnership with God in engaging their children's faith. Howard Snyder argues that, quote, a key missiological implication of preceding grace is that God is the first, the originating missionary. This is central to God's mission. God is already active in all persons. Stonehouse extrapolates this idea into the grace of the parental mission. Writing from infancy, God draws children in love as children respond to the grace-inspired desire to know God. Even though they may not be able to name that desire grows and leads them on. Early Methodist practice evidenced a belief in the outworking of the potential of prevenient grace as parent and child engage together in faith community. As inborn sin and ever-present preventing grace were both taken seriously, so also was the potential for salvation and sanctification in the life of the child. Here is a crucial area for reflective engagement for parents and ministry leaders in our current context. Do we take children's sin seriously? But also, do we take children's potential for sanctification seriously? And is there a connection between how earnestly we respond to children's potential to sin and children's potential for growth and holiness? Wesley was earnest in his personal work with children and demanded his preachers either spend time with children or give up their positions. Methodist preachers were to not only encourage families to practice the means of grace, such as prayer, but societies of children were formed wherever possible. Parents were not abandoned to caretake their children's faith on their own, but parent and child received the blessings of the broader Christian community in witnessing the presence of God in their work together. Children were empowered to take up their own faith, and young people were often at the core of early Methodist revivals. In Wesleyan thought, parenting required an urgent sense of the destructive potential of sin and the needful surrender to the available grace that could enliven parent and child, and by extension, the whole faith community, to the love of God. And this is so beautifully captured in the Wesleyan parenting hymn. And when I read this, I thought, what would it be like for our churches and parents today to sing a hymn like this? For worms of earth, for help we cry, for grace to guide what grace hath given. We ask for wisdom from on high to train our infant up for heaven. Raising children in the home was a location for early Methodist parents to receive God's grace for themselves and to witness it unfolding in the lives of their children, emanating out from the home and into the world. Now we'll move on to the fun one, the gift of correction. While a parent was to surrender to this grace, Wesley was adamant that they never give up being vigilant in expecting obedience. Perhaps one of the most difficult teachings of Wesley to the parent today might be reconciling with his demand that self-will must be destroyed in the child. He instructed parents that they, quote, should begin to break the will the first moment it appears, to bring his will into subjection to yours, that it may be afterwards subjected to the will of God. Now, this might seem an admonition a step too far, even for the conservative evangelical parents my parents' generation that raised us on Dr. Dobson's famous line, shape the will, don't break the will. Some of us remember that one. But what is here for my generation of parents who are raising children in a culture that glorifies personal identity and self-will? First of all, it bears noting, as scholar Colleen Durr wrote, that Wesley's preaching to break the will was not a descriptive methodology to be employed, but an outcome to be achieved: obedience. It was well documented that Susanna Wesley had a profound impact on John Wesley's model for family religion. And it's important to note that while she was a firm disciplinarian, she had to be with 10 kids, she also consistently appreciated the individual needs and concerns of her children, taking the long view of transforming a child towards repentance and the reception of grace. She famously set aside an hour each week for each of her children to focus on their individual needs. I don't know, Matthew, do you remember when John, I think John was like Friday morning at 10, hour with Jackie every week, right? So she set aside an hour for each of her kids to focus on their individual needs. So Wesley was raised within this framework. And coming out of that, he's inviting parents to prudently use the authority they had with their children as an opportunity to invite God into the ongoing work of forming each of their children in their context and according to their character. This can be understood in likeness to the way Wesley spoke of works of mercy as a means of grace to those who visited the sick. He wrote, quote, "Being superior in rank to them, you have more influence. Your inferiors, of course, look up to you with a kind of reverence, and the condescension which you show in visiting them gives them a prejudice in your favor, which inclines them to hear you with attention and willingly receive what you have to say." Durr clarifies that obedience taught in an environment that is consistent, persistent, and spirit-filled is obedience not motivated by fear and anxiety, but obedience motivated by trust and faith. We see this in On Family Religion when Wesley instructs that training children is a glorious and important trust. Seeing one soul is of more value than all the world beside. Every child, therefore, you are to watch over with the utmost care. In so much as children should be humbled, so too should parents by this sacred task before them, a gift of a good father. I think it bears noting that Wesley was writing this long before our modern theories of how trust functions as a critical function of child development. And yet, I think he intuited the spiritual ramifications of trust between parent and child as a model of trust between child and God. If you think about it, a small child cannot understand the abstract idea of humble obedience to God. But parents, working as tangible channels for God's transformative love, can serve as concrete models by being earthly parents whom they can see, feel, hear, and touch. If we look at training a child as a means of grace, a place to encounter the loving presence of God, it can be appreciated that a parent is not about the work of crushing their child's spirit, but enlivening them to relationship with God as they are humbled in obedience to parent. Again, Wesley's conceptualization is not humiliation of the child's will, but humility in conformity to the will of God. Wesley was always clear that encouragement should be careful and judicious, so that children might always look upon, quote, all they have as a free gift of God, and with the deepest self-abasement say, not unto us, but unto thy name give the praise. For Wesley, the Christian journey is about continual growth into the image of God in Christ, a restoration to what we lost in Eden. In our modern sensibilities, we can conflate will and identity, but for Wesley, obedience at the expense of self-will was not a question of losing identity, but being born again into new life in Christ, where the image of God is stamped on the heart. For Wesley, there was no graduation ceremony from the school of obedience in this life. In his preaching on the works of mercy to a presumably adult audience, Wesley wrote that one must, quote, cry to him for the whole spirit of humility, lest if pride steal into your heart, let your heart wait upon him for a continual supply of meekness and gentleness. Think nothing too mean to do for him. To train a child for a life of obedience was to anticipate an entire life of obedience. As soon as children began to internalize this requisite humility, they could participate in the full range of the means of grace. There was a hymn encouraging children to explore these practices, and Wesley wrote prayers specifically for children to use. He believed children could become means of grace through testifying to their own personal experiences of transformational practice. And he circulated children's testimonies among the Methodists, alongside the adult ones, as inspirations for others. No doubt this encouragement rebounded back into the home as parents were encouraged by the faith of their children. Realizing that the hard work of promoting obedience in the home could bear fruit for the entire faith community. Discipline and training children in obedience was not a burden, but a blessing for both parent and child as they grew in grace together, both on a transformational journey into the image of God. I think the implication for us today is to consider how we speak to parents about the joy of discipline and the gift of helping to shape our children into the image of God. It's not, again, that we are downloading a set of rules into our children so they will hopefully be moral beings and virtuous adults. Through his enabling grace, parents are invited to partner with God to reveal a new way of being in this world that demands humility, but promises grace, blessing, and abundant life. So finally, we move to the gift of instruction. And Wesley had a deep and abiding faith in the ability of the hard and holy work of parenting to bear fruit in the rigorous practice he demanded for family faith formation. He admonished parents to, quote, particularly endeavor to instruct children early, plainly, frequently, and patiently. As we have seen, Wesley did not think children were morally blank slates in the sense that they were born into this world with the stain of original sin, alongside the potential that comes with prevenient grace. However, in On the Education of Children, Wesley preached that due to the profound relational split that occurred at the fall, children did not have an innate concept of God. Children were empty of both knowledge and holy desire. And for parents to neglect constant conversation on the things of God in daily life was tantamount to encouraging atheism in the home. Strong words from a man given to strong language, but certainly challenging. And I remember when I first read this sermon and reading that line, I'm like, how often am I talking to my kids about the faith? And yeah, like, am I encouraging atheism by not talking about it more, right? Does God matter? What do we make of this? Yes, it is important to note that Wesley did not understand this to be a purely didactic task of intellectual transference. Rather, the parent could be reliant on God and in faith, surrender to his transformative work in both parent and child. Catherine Stonehouse contends that, quote, Wesley showed parents that their relationship with God and the life they lived would be more important than all the verbal instruction they could provide. And I was thinking of that this morning when Jessica was speaking about embodying the story. Are we embodying the story for our children? Isn't that what parenting is? Christian parenting, we're embodying a story for our kids. Ultimately, this is not an informational process with a fixed end in a moment of conversion, but a dynamic process that is fed by a living experience of God's goodness and love. And there's an excellent example of this witnessed in the sermon on family religion, where Wesley advocates for taking a child on a walk and pointing to the sun as an example of God's goodness, proclaiming, "He loves to make you happy. Should not you then love him?" In this context, a parent can serve as an avenue of grace for their child, testifying to their spirit of a confidence in God's love. As this is done in a spirit of prayer and discernment, the parent is also confronted with their own reliance on and need for God's warming love to shine deep into their own souls. A crucial aspect of understanding Wesley's theology of the means of grace is appreciating the value of presence and how physical availability to each other invites the work of God's Spirit. And I've done three papers for Dr. Pedler on Wesleyan discipleship the last three semesters. This was the first one. I did adult class and band meetings for another one, and I just finished with Holy Dying. And consistently throughout Wesleyan discipleship is this idea of how we are present to each other physically. And when we are present to each other physically, the Spirit of God will be made manifest. In writing on works of mercy and visiting the sick, Wesley chastises those who abdicate their responsibility for caretaking to physicians, writing, quote, "His going would not fulfill your duty, neither would it do the same good to you unless you saw them with your own eyes. If you do not, you lose a means of grace. You lose an excellent means of increasing your faithfulness to God." So, in light of this, it can be asked, how would Wesley view parents who abdicate opportunities to be fully present to their children? In a spirit of constantly, parents can be a blessing to their children as a means of grace. Wesley would tell us, don't miss an opportunity to be present to your children. It is a gift of God. The place I love to be most present to my children is in my car. Because if any of you are mothers, you know you spend a lot of time in the car with your children. And since I've been doing this work, I've been thinking, how is this time I spend in the car with my kids a means of grace, an opportunity to be present with them before the Lord? It's a gift of God. As he concluded in a sermon on family religion, quote, "Let you, your children, be all on the Lord's side, sweetly drawing together in one yoke, walking in all commandments and ordinances, till every one of you shall receive his own reward according to his own labor." This is a family is a lifelong journey with an eternal destination. So my personal mission statement for our family, and I formed this in one of my courses I took at Tyndale, we were challenged to do a vision frame for an area of our life. So this was mine for our family. And I came up with this and I shared it with Matthew, and he goes, "That's Wesley." So I thought it was original, but it was Wesley. To inhale God's presence in every day of our life so that we can exhale God's goodness in every way of our life. So, as an aside, if any of you have children in the home, or even if you don't, or your children are older or whatever, think about this. What's your family mission statement, right? What are you about? What is the intentionality here? But our statement here actually comes from Wesley's sermon, The New Birth, where he speaks of spiritual regeneration using the analogy of respiration. He says, "God is continually breathing, as it were, upon his soul, and his soul is breathing unto God. as by a kind of spiritual respiration, the life of God in the soul is sustained, and the child of God grows up till he comes to the full measure of the stature of Christ. This has implications for how Wesley envisioned human interactions and communion with each other as a means of grace, be it between parent and child, or parent and child and faith community. And considering this analogy, there is a sense in which, so far as the faithful are each day only sustained by their constant inhalation of God's grace and exhalation to his glory, they are equally held by God's love and enabled to respond, be they man, woman, or child. As a parent, I am testifying to myself as I testify to my child. I am remembering that God gives us all the goodness we have, every good thought and word and work are from him. Without him, we can neither think anything right or do it. As a parent, I am convicted in humility of my need to draw close to God's heart of love as I continue to grow in holiness. Charles Wesley wrote the following hymn for children, but I think for all of us who accept our adoption as children of God, it's for us. Come and call me by my name, whisper to my listening heart, stir me up to seek thy face, claim me in my tender years, manifest the word of grace. Maybe we need to bring back some songwriting about parenting and family and songs for children that are theologically substantive like this. Charles Wesley certainly left us an abundant legacy in that regard. So in conclusion, what does Wesleyan theology on parenting and family religion have to say to the church almost 300 years later on in our history? Gail Felton writes, quote, Wesley's deep involvement in education of children should challenge the contemporary church to take increased responsibility for the spiritual and moral development of the young. And I think we mentioned this a little bit in the previous seminar, but COVID kind of exposed some things to the church, I think, as far as how we value children's ministry, where it belongs, how are parents being empowered or not. Indeed, early Methodist thought and practice have much to recommend to us in an era when children's ministries have been marginalized and sent to the church basement and the kids have been dismissed. And Christian parents struggle with apathy on one side and feelings of inadequacy on the other. While a parent today might be challenged by Wesley's seeming severity on sin, disobedience, and rigorous practice, a fuller picture demands a consideration of prevenient grace, the blessings of community, and the value of cultivating humility in preparing to encounter God through life and the means of grace. It is an ongoing and incessant work for the parent, but potentially enlivening as they draw closer to God in encountering his presence, both with and for their child. In Wesleyan theology, God is the operative agent at work in the life of the child from the very beginning. Parents can surrender to the power of God's Spirit by acknowledging their child's state of sin, self-will, and ignorance, while also imagining their mutual potential for growth in holiness, obedience, and knowledge of God. Parent and child are invited to receive God's love while they serve as a prudential means of grace for each other in God's continually sanctifying work. Thank you.